sir. He's uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
Hello out there in Cyberland. The Metaverse. The word was coined by Neal Stephenson in the book Snow Crash. It was a physical space where people could interact online, a digital playground where the people were only limited by their imagination. Facebook has changed its name to Meta, and it's trying to build an actual metaverse. Now other companies are rushing to get a piece of Mark Zuckerberg's vision of the future. What is the metaverse, and what is Mark Zuckerberg's vision of the future? What does this actually mean concretely? Here to help me puzzle out this nightmarish world Silicon Valley billionaires want for us is Motherboard Senior Editor Janice Rose and Panopticon Expert and College Professor Chris Gilliard. I'm Matthew Galt, and this is Cyber. So, thank you both so much for joining me.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I feel like the marketing hype around this thing, this metaverse, is already grossly out of control. Can one of you tell me exactly what the pitch here actually is? Janice, I know you recently wrote something about this.
Yeah, so basically Mark Zuckerberg for a while has been teasing sort of like a vision of virtual reality as a sort of next phase to social media. This was basically the first time this was ever hinted at was when, of course, Facebook bought Oculus in, I think, 2014 for $2 billion. It was a big deal at the time, but it was also kind of a bit mysterious because nobody really understood at the time, like how does this work with the larger sort of like Facebook mission of social media. And basically at the time, Mark Zuckerberg like described virtual reality and, you know, like this kind of embodied virtual experience as like the next computing platform is the way he described it. And sort of like as a successor to the sort of like two-dimensional social media, sharing likes and posts and all this other stuff that we're used to doing on social media. So then in 2016, they finally sort of debuted for the first time a live demonstration of the virtual reality technology as it would apply to Facebook and like basically like showed for the first time like what they're sort of thinking when it comes to this sort of this technology as a form of socializing. And it was a very awkward and, of course, like cringeworthy sort of demo with Mark Zuckerberg, like having this like embodied virtual avatar and like, you know, sort of transporting to his like glass walled office, transporting to his home where there was a camera set off where you could like wave at his like pooley sheepdog and like all kinds of other things. And it was sort of just this like introduction where Facebook was trying to establish itself as a VR company. And I guess now with the announcement of Meta, we have a sort of like more complete vision of like what Facebook's intentions are. And, you know, using the term metaverse, which you were saying is, you know, something coined by science fiction authors as this like kind of alternate reality where we exist as digital avatars, kind of like as an escapist fantasy in a lot of ways. And like, yeah, the other thing is like, you know, the way that this was depicted in science fiction literature is never as like a utopian thing. It was always depicted as like, well, the real world is so messed up that like the only thing we can do to like enjoy our existences is to inhabit these virtual spaces where we can at least give ourselves the illusion that we live in a better world. And Mark Zuckerberg's, you know, of course, vision for this is that it's all controlled by Facebook/Meta. And, you know, we live in these like embodied spaces, and that's sort of what he was demonstrating for the announcement of Meta was like, you know, digital avatars, buying things from like marketplaces, buying like digital items, decorating a virtual house, and living this kind of like Sims-like existence in the metaverse. And that's kind of where we're at now. And of course, you know, there's all kinds of problems which we can talk about where what happens when Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg are the ones that are in control of this, you know, whole experience.
Am I still distorted and strange?
Yes.
Okay. A little bit.
Let's try.
You're a little better now, but like definitely during the intro, it was like very, you might need to re-record the intro.
I'm going to have to re-record it. Let me try.
Recording stopped.
If I turn off the redundancy, how do I sound now?
Now you sound good.
Okay, that's what it was doing. The computer can't handle doing both of those things. Okay.
Yeah. I had to like very quickly turn down my speaker because I was worried that since I wasn't muted, it was going to feed back. And
yeah, I'm so sorry about that. But yeah, I can re-record the intro. All right. So let's get into that, Janice, because, you know, one of the things that inspired this particular episode is your recent piece in Motherboard, Zuckerberg's meta endgame is monetizing all human behavior. And you kind of hinted at that just now. So what do you see as the end goal for him when he is in control of people's interactions online?
Right. So I think like to answer this question, it helps to go back to like the beginning of the web as we know it and the way that advertising has kind of integrated itself into the web and websites. And basically like when the internet started becoming a popular sort of destination for, you know, news and like sites that people would frequent and people were trying to figure out how to make money off of this, you know, advertising was what crept in, as it always does, to that space. And basically what they would do is that they would measure people's interactions with the websites, and they still do this to this day. And so that's where we get all of these like trackers, which, you know, like there are countless extensions that you can install for browsers that like block trackers that basically like take note of what web pages you visit, like what sites you visit, and then kind of track you across the web, track all your interactions. And specifically, you know, all of this activity, all of this like surveillance that's going on in the two-dimensional web is limited or has been limited to like clicks and scrolls and like, you know, how long your mouse hovers over certain elements of a page, you know, how long you read an article, like what you highlight with your mouse on the page, all of that can be collected and measured and is recorded and basically sold as advertising data by these various, you know, data brokers and various people who make money off of, you know, doing sort of like web tracking and web surveillance. The natural sort of like business model of Facebook has been tracking everyone's interactions across a platform they control, which is also two-dimensional and which like encompasses, you know, basically things that people like, things that people interact with, and then optimizing everything to basically like show more content that they're more likely to interact with. And that's basically like kind of the golden, you know, the golden goal of all advertising and all surveillance is to basically monitor the way that humans interact with things and then change the environment to get them to interact more. And that's kind of like where we got where we're at now with the whole situation with like Cambridge Analytica and like all of the various scandals that have plagued Facebook for years and years now, which all basically boil down to Facebook is recording everything about how people interact with each other on their platform. And then they're then using that data in order to optimize an algorithm, which then shows content that people are more likely to interact with. And that causes this like feedback loop where basically, you know, people are being shown more things that they're more likely to interact with. And then that cascades and becomes, you know, kind of like QAnon and all of these various conspiracy outlets and like, you know, basically reinforces people's existing biases by like reinforcing them and giving them more and more content. And so when it comes to Meta and when it comes to virtual reality, that whole dynamic, that is Facebook's business model. Like indisputably, that is Facebook's business model. They make money by measuring interactions, by measuring people's, the way that people interact and their activity on the internet. And then they use that data in order to change or manipulate people's behavior with an algorithm that prioritizes certain content over other content. So when it comes to the metaverse, and when it comes to like these, what I like to call them embodied virtual spaces or embodied spaces, because that's basically what they are, is like you have, as opposed to the two-dimensional web where you're basically limited in, I'm on this page, I'm scrolling through this page, I'm clicking on things in this page. You're now sort of embodying, like with, you know, virtual reality and video games and like this virtual technology, what you're doing is you're actually inhabiting a embodied form of some kind, whether that's an avatar or something else. And you're interacting with a three-dimensional sort of like environment. And the way that those technologies work is that they use sensors, and the sensors measure movement. They measure body movements. They measure head movements. They can sometimes, although it's not, I don't think it's very advanced yet. There's some technology that can measure eye movements and iris detection and like various forms of like telling what a person is looking at. There are actually companies that that do this specifically for game developers, where, you know, there will be developers who are interested in knowing like what parts of their virtual world are people interacting with more. And so they will basically get this software that's made by analytics companies that measures people's head movements on the virtual headsets. And then they will use that data to basically like optimize and figure out like, oh, people are interacting or looking at this more than they're looking at this. And so we're going to like tweak our game or our product or whatever to do that, to, you know, better reflect that. So what that basically gets to is like, you know, what I've written before and is like, you know, if Facebook's business model is to algorithmically affect what people interact with on the internet based on their own data, based on data that's taken from their previous interactions, then it's pretty safe to assume that that's kind of the same goal with Meta, is to take these physical interactions, these like physical movements, physical behaviors, and then use those as like another form of data that can be used to like prioritize content and basically show people advertising and other things like that.
Chris, this sounds like your nightmare.
Absolutely. I mean, that's like a really full, I can really not add too much to that, but I did want to go back and note that one of the things Janice mentioned is the 2016 VR debut that Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg did, and it was awkward and cringy, but also featured Zuckerberg and whoever else was there touring hurricane ravaged Puerto Rico. It's very sort of emblematic of what's wrong with Zuckerberg and Facebook and the way that they look at the world. My running joke is kind of my claim that every future imagined by a tech company is worse than its previous iteration. I think it is absolutely nightmarish if we think about everything that Facebook has done that has harmed our world, our democracy, that, you know, has aided genocide, and on and on and on. If we think about moving that into a situation, a universe, a platform, however you want to think about it, that's even more controlled by Zuckerberg and dictated by the likes of Zuckerberg and Boz and other Facebook folks. Yeah, absolutely a nightmare.
Can you tell the audience just a little bit more generally kind of about your work and what you focus on?
Yeah. So, my day job is not Twitter. My day job is actually, I'm an English professor. But I'm really interested and do a lot of work, writing, reading, sometimes speaking on privacy and surveillance, particularly how these things affect marginalized communities. Do some work to looking at things like algorithmic bias, but essentially the things I'm interested in are the ways that technologies often have a disparate impact, disparate harmful impact on marginalized communities. That's it in a nutshell.
So it's not just Zuckerberg, right? A lot of these other, I think a lot of people are kind of rushing into this space saying the word metaverse, and it's almost like marketing. They don't really know what it means. They maybe don't care. But big companies are moving into this space. Chris, why do you think there is a rush for big tech to build these virtual worlds?
I think Janice got into it quite a bit, but I think there's a real desire to latch onto the next big thing. I think the pandemic has in some ways shown people that, I guess how I would say it is that there's this belief now that because there's so much danger still with physical contact, that people are going to continue to operate online in ways that they have for the past year and a half, 2 years. And that more and more as people work from home and do school from home and do kind of, a lot of people do almost everything from home, that the next big thing will be these sort of interfaces where you can do all of these things in an embodied way. I think also that there's this sense that a lot of companies, a lot of journalists, a lot of just in general have, when a billionaire says something, or in Zuckerberg's case, billionaire. When a billionaire says something, we've started to accept it as true or as fate or as inevitable. And so a trillion-dollar company says something like we're going all in on the metaverse, that's a sign to other companies that they should probably do that as well, that they want to be on the front end of these things. And also they want to sort of join Facebook, but also not necessarily have Facebook be the one to dictate all the terms about what these things are going to look like.
I want to throw out a quote from John Carmack, who is the game designer behind Doom, and also did a lot of work with Oculus until recently. Was interviewed on the Joe Rogan podcast, where all the best ideas are voiced aloud. Not everyone can have a mansion. Not everyone can have a home theater. These are things we can simulate to some degree in virtual reality. Now, the simulation is not as good as the real thing. If you are rich and you have your own home theater or mansion and private island, good for you. You're probably not the people that are going to benefit most. Most of the people in the world live in cramped quarters that are not what they would choose if they had unlimited resources. And he kind of goes on to advocate that says, like, the climate's going to get worse. He lives in Dallas, and I can attest that that it is very hot there almost all of the time. And that it basically advocating VR as a way to mitigate and solve these problems. What do you both think of that? Janice, if you want to go first.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this is I hate to use this term like lightly, but I think that's like classic neoliberal, solutionism, like tech solutionism, where it's like, okay, well, these problems that we caused, us being the owner class, the people with all these resources that are using it to enrich ourselves, we can't fix those things. But here, we're going to give you this nice little virtual private island so that you can enjoy your miserable existence slightly more. I feel like I saw someone say something like this on Twitter. I forget who it was, but basically this idea that I feel like on a large, more general scale, I think that a lot of really powerful people see a lot of potential in a thing like the metaverse, because they see it as a form of escapism, as a form of distraction, as a form of here's something we can, in the same way that Facebook is right now, right? Like a lot of people use Facebook as social media, right? Like the endless scrolling, the addictive properties of, you know, and I'm not one of those people who's just like, oh, like social media is inherently bad and it's bad for your brain and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And like the internet is bad and technology is bad. Like, I'm not one of those people who says that, but like, it's also like really important to acknowledge that there is an addictive aspect to social media and it's designed that way. And like, that's part of the whole problem here is that like these algorithms that are designed to prioritize content that we're more likely to interact with based on our previous interactions. And, you know, you think about that and then just like put it into like sort of an embodied virtual space. And it's, you know, it has this potential. And this is like what I saw somebody saying, which is like, you know, I think that on some level, the people who have a lot of power and money and influence are all for that because it sort of enables this sort of like almost like this mass psychosis where people can just kind of like indulge into this world. And then it allows them to more easily sort of forget that like we're being given this as a replacement for not fixing the world that we actually live in. And it kind of gives them an out, you know, it kind of takes, I forget what the term for this is, but like in political theory, there's like it's kind of along the lines of opiate of the masses, although I hate using that term because it's just very, you know, cringy at this point. But like there is a term for, you know, when you show something in a safe fantasy setting as a way of satisfying people's urge to engage in something, but do it in a way which doesn't threaten capital and doesn't threaten the people who have the power to fix problems and who have the resources, and it doesn't ultimately threaten them. I think like one really good example of this is the show Mr. Robot. I love that show. I actually, it's like one of my favorite TV shows of the past couple of years, but I remember a friend said something about like, you know, this depicts like a revolution, right? It depicts like this like hacker revolution, but it puts it into the realm of fantasy. And like, in a way, like a corporate sort of like TV show that does this takes that and puts it into this realm of fantasy. And in doing so, does it make us less likely to like actually want to do that in the real world? Because we've already satisfied our, you know, our sort of need to like indulge that fantasy about overthrowing, you know, the rich and the capitalist class. So like, I think like, a lot of powerful people really are rooting for Mark Zuckerberg and for Facebook and for Meta, because they recognize that this is like a way to get people disengaged from political processes, disengaged from, you know, things like that. And like, who knows if that's just one potential result. Like this thing could not take off. The metaverse could be another overblown idea. It could be another Silicon Valley pipe dream. But I think that like, it's also worth mentioning that like, this is definitely something that I think a lot of powerful people want to happen. And yeah, Chris mentioned before, like, you know, we tend to hear a billionaire say something and then just assume it as like an inevitability, right? Like Facebook says they're going to do something. Oh, it's the future. And then people start, you know, getting on the boat. But I think like, that's something that a lot of powerful companies always want people to believe is that technology is inevitable, but it's never inevitable. It's always, you know, it's the companies that make it seem that way to kind of like do this kind of like process of manufactured consent where everyone's like, oh, well, privacy is dead. So, you know, might as well. But like that whole idea of privacy being dead again is like, you know, taken from that same idea where it's like, it's not something that's actually true. It's just something that, you know, a lot of people want you to think is true.
Right. The fights are still ongoing. You know, that's why we're having this conversation. Chris, you're a great coiner of phrases. One of the ones that really caught my eye in relation to this conversation is luxury surveillance.
Yeah.
Can you explain that concept and how it might apply here? And if it doesn't, then please tell me.
Yeah, I do. I think it does. I want to jump back real quickly though. I mean, I think in that statement you read, one of the things that often goes unexamined, and I hope to tie this into luxury surveillance is, right, the idea that all of us want, you know, to, you know, that our dream is to consume more than, you know, any human being should, right? Like, to take up more space and to use more resources and to extract more from the earth than any one person should. Yeah, that's actually not my dream. So, like, I don't want a mansion, you know, and I certainly don't want a fake one while the world crumbles down around me. The way I think about luxury surveillance is it initially came about because I made what at the time I thought was a really sort of basic assertion, which is that ankle monitors and Fitbits and Apple Watches all perform many of the same functions. It seemed very obvious to me, but some people had not seen it that way. And so I started to just sort of tease that out a little bit more and to think about, like, some of the differences are not, in fact, like, what those devices do, but who chooses to wear them and who has those technologies deployed against them or are forced to wear them. And in some cases, the other larger thing to think about with these devices is their aesthetic appeal. Now, the Apple Watch is getting larger and larger, so it's starting to more and more resemble ankle monitors and things like watches that are used to monitor formerly incarcerated people. But it's basically, when I talk about or think about luxury surveillance, it's items that are generally associated with people who are wealthy or well off, that perform a surveillance function or a variety of surveillance functions, but that are not often thought of as primarily surveillance devices. Again, like a Fitbit, Apple Watch, a Tesla, smart homes, things like that. And I think, to the extent that many of, you know, Janice, talked about the surveillance aspects of VR and the metaverse, right? Whether that's the tracking of people's facial muscles and eye tracking, or a way that being entirely embodied in a world controlled by one company or a set of companies, and it would enable a level of tracking that sort of heretofore was kind of only dreamed of. And this is as someone who is pretty well aware of the far-reaching extent that surveillance catches all of us in our everyday lives. But yeah, right now, I mean, a lot of these headsets are not things that are available to the average person, I would say, price-wise. They're not, although they do have many surveillance functions, they're not thought of, at least in the scholarship I've read or pay attention to, they're not thought of primarily as surveillance devices, but that is a very essential function to what they do.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Right, I'm kind of fascinated by this big VR push from mostly gaming companies and Facebook, but mostly gaming companies, because there's so many issues with just getting people in a VR headset in the first place. It makes some people nauseous. Some people just can't use it.
I still can't to this day. To this day, I get nauseous. I cannot use any of these things.
Some people get very, like, they're hot. You can get very uncomfortable very quickly. It's quite a bit of weight on your head, depending on which model you're using. And it's expensive. The cheapest model that you can get, the cheapest Oculus is $300, right? But you scale up into luxury versions that are $1,000 and more from Valve and from HTC. And it is wild to me that they think that they're going to push this thing and get everyone to adopt them when there are so many problems. And it's been very interesting to me to watch people like Gabe Newell and Mark Zuckerberg and Carmack push this and not really discuss any of those downsides or issues or drawbacks.
I mean, one other thing to note really briefly is that they actually don't even fit on some people's heads, depending on what your head looks like and what kind of hair you have, you know. But yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's like definitely a lot of this is like following in the same pattern of so much Silicon Valley technology, where the people who are, you know, perhaps like who are like either, you know, physically disabled or neuroatypical, or who are not the sort of like quote unquote majority that they're initially designing for, are all considered like edge cases. And so that like the design process always seems to completely exclude those people in the first place, because they see it as something that they can sort of iterate later. And then sometimes they will not actually iterate it later, but it's like one of those things where they'll just try to push it on a large enough audience as they can without, you know, kind of considering without taking those things seriously in the beginning in the design process.
Right. And I think back to when we had that day without Facebook, you know, where their back end completely shit the bed earlier this year. And you know, my take on that was that, and I wrote about this at Motherboard, that we forget how integrated Facebook is into the internet itself outside of America. Right. So imagine a future where commerce has to be conducted through this virtual headset, or like large parts of commerce, maybe not the whole thing, obviously. But where you have, people for whatever reason that are completely cut off from various parts of human interaction because they can't use these devices because it's all moved online. Anyway,
that's, yeah. Have you seen the anime movie called Summer Wars? That's basically no. The plot of Summer Wars.
Really?
It's like a mass. Yeah. It takes place in this, it's a story about like this kid and this girl, and like basically it takes place in this massive, like basically what Facebook would become if it was like even more all-encompassing, and it's like all commerce in the world is and then a hacker like infiltrates it and like brings everything down, and like the whole system is controlled by this one hacker, and it's like up to the hero to like save the metaverse basically, and in doing so save the world, because so much all human interaction goes through this one system. It's like, it's not a very critical piece of cinema. It doesn't really like examine like, huh, well maybe we shouldn't have this like massive metaverse that's controlled by one company and is like a giant central point of failure. But like it is cute. And basically what you said just now is like the plot summary of Summer Wars.
Why? This is one of the things I hate about living right now, is that I feel like every stupid idea that comes out of Elon Musk or Zuckerberg's mouth is the plot of some dystopian sci-fi something somewhere that they thought was a good idea. And I know they've read them. They've read these books, and they take the completely wrong lesson. Anyway, that's the whole other episode.
Yeah. Matthew, the other thing I wanted to, I think it's to say is I think it's understated the extent to which Facebook is even infrastructure in the U.S. I mean, thank goodness on that day without Facebook that there wasn't some type of, not that I'm aware of anyway, it was some type of disaster that required people to log on to Facebook, you know, because schools use Facebook, you know, cities use it as their, you know, instead of a city having a website, now they have a Facebook page. And so, I mean, I think back to when there was the climate issues in Texas with the freezing, that I think it was Austin that was asking everyone to go to the Facebook page in order to watch the city's announcement on what steps to do next for people who are, you know, in danger. And yeah, I mean, to further embed really critical structures into Facebook's system, I think is extremely dangerous. And also, I mean, again, renders people subject to all kinds of surveillance and harms that they shouldn't have to engage in or be a part of just to go live their daily lives.
Yeah, I think it's also worth mentioning definitely like just how much I think people in the global north don't understand that like Facebook is such an essential communications infrastructure to large parts of the global south. Like that's just where it's Facebook and it's WhatsApp, which is owned by Facebook. So like when something happens like this and Facebook goes down and its DNS gets, you know, messed up, like that is it. You know, a lot of these places don't have infrastructure. They just have, they just have Facebook.
I want to talk about some of the algorithms and things that underpin a lot of this stuff too. So this is something, Chris, I know we've written about it, Motherboard, and Chris, I know you're kind of an expert in, we've danced around it a little bit. I want to get really specific. So there's this perception that computers are without bias, but that is completely false. Correct. Can you kind of tease this out for us?
Yeah. I mean, I guess, it's,
I know it's short, a big question. It's,
right? I mean, the thing is, I think that the only people left making this claim are either people who are completely ill-informed or completely disingenuous. You know, we could talk about the ways that these, a lot of these systems are trained. We can talk about the people who design these systems with no input from the community or no expertise in the particular area for which they're supposedly designing a thing. I mean, but the simplest way to put it is that systems reflect the culture and the biases of the people who make them. And so it's not really possible. And I, you know, again, some people would push back against this, but in my understanding or estimation, it's not really possible to create unbiased systems. I think in some ways we started to lose lose the argument on this because so much of the focus now has been for companies to say, well, we've had like bias auditing and things like that, right? And we're free of bias. You know, for instance, like there's a company that does like algorithmic hiring, and does things. And so they did like an outside company come and say they were sort of free of bias, which just by the nature of what they do, they cannot be. And I don't think such a thing exists. But I do think, sorry, this is like a long rant on like what I hoped would be like a more succinct answer. But because these systems reflect the biases of the culture and the people who create them, I think the company pushback now from a lot of tech companies has been to say, okay, like we're going to sort of bias wash by having third parties come in and look at us and rubber stamp us. But the problem with that is that there's sort of never a way to completely erase the bias of things, often because the very nature of what these things do is deeply embedded in like kind of like a very discriminatory history, but also like the thing that they're trying to do is in itself very discriminatory.
Can you give give us some concrete examples?
Let's take Facebook for instance, or Meta. Right. And so one of the things that we see often, right, is that that ad targeting on Facebook. Okay. And so it's come out very often that the algorithmically determined categories that Facebook often has allows people to do ad targeting in some very discriminatory and often hateful ways. Whether that's not showing job ads or apartment ads to a particular ethnic group or age group, or allowing people to target advertising based on your some kind of like hate affinity, like your hate of a certain group or things like that, whether that be Jewish people or Black people or on and on and on. So we've seen that over and over again. And so the cycle of that is typically that a researcher, academic, or journalist discovers that Facebook is doing this, Facebook makes some tweak and says they're not doing it. And then days, weeks, months later, they find out that they're still doing it, right? Or they're doing it. You can still do that thing, but in a slightly different way, right? So I now no longer, so I'm being careful to try to use accurate language. But for instance, Facebook used to let people target ads based on whether or not you hated Jews. Okay. Now, so Facebook makes a tweak so that that specific thing is not a thing you can do in that way. But the very nature of like the surveillance mechanism is what Facebook does, and that they cater to trying to micro-target people based on affinities that are determined by Facebook, makes it so that it's never not going to be discriminatory. It's only going to be discriminatory in different ways.
Right. The it's baked into the system itself.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's how it makes money.
Or if we think about hiring tools, right? And so, you know, sort of famously, Amazon had a tool that they said they never put into place, but that would put forth men based on the history of Amazon kind of mainly hiring men, you know, things like that. But a lot of these tools look at things. So like the history of hiring people in the US is racist and sexist and ableist. And so if you're going to base in any way your future hiring on past hiring, then there's no way to make it not racist, sexist, and ableist. So the nature of what you're trying to do based on the systems that you're using means that you're never going to eliminate the thing you say you want to eliminate.
The foundations are bad.
Yeah.
I know there's like one, I don't know if you know Oz Keyes, who's a researcher, who I think has been featured in Motherboard a couple of times, but they have a paper where they show a demonstration. It's a white paper where they show a demonstration of a system that algorithmically determines which old people should be turned into mulch. And they note that it's extremely fair and that it does not discriminate against any genders or races or anything. And it's like I really like that as an example for like what you've been describing, Chris, because that's like, it's like the foundational aspect of what you're building is based on these like extremely biased and racist and terrible systems. And so like, it doesn't actually matter. And like, I feel like the idea of fairness has become sort of like the term that a lot of these companies have adopted, and the idea of fairness. And it's actually like, I was thinking of writing something about this recently, because it's like actually a really terrible metric for harm, right? Like the idea of fairness, like things can be fair, but they can still be harmful, because if what you're doing is inherently harmful, it doesn't matter how fair it is. Like, it doesn't matter if people are equally harmed, which they usually aren't. They're, you know, but it's the kind of thing where, you know, we're needing to get more deep into sort of like I like to call algorithms ideological systems, because really what they're doing is they're taking someone's ideology and they're encoding it into a sort of like, you know, inescapable computer says yes, computer says no format. And that's kind of the whole idea, is like we need to like recognize the role that ideology plays in the creation of these systems and who they're being designed for. Like who is in mind, like who is being kept in mind when these systems are designed, and who are they being designed in order to benefit ultimately? Because in the case of, you know, Facebook, you know, this is being designed to benefit Mark Zuckerberg and his company and other things. And that's kind of like how we get to a place where we have a system that algorithmically prioritizes some content over others, even if it's like based on the metric of, you know, hating Jews or something terrible like that. That's how we get there. It's because like, that is what the system is built to do. It's built to prioritize content based on user interaction, regardless of whether that content is good or bad.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me a lot of Kathy O'Neill's definition, which, you know, she says algorithms are opinions embedded in code. You know, and I think one of the things I think is always important to remember when we have these discussions is the extent to which a lot of times code or math or algorithms are used in a way to legitimate things that people would want to do anyway. You know, I mean, I think of one of the famous examples in my city, right, Detroit, where a black man was falsely implicated by facial recognition, you know, and the cops slipped up and said, oh, well, I suppose the machine is wrong, right? So, yeah. Like, the idea was, you know, that the guy, the machine is the ultimate arbiter of whether something is true or false, right? Whether the guy was there or says it's him, or whether anyone else recognized him or thought he was there, are all irrelevant. It's whether the machine says it or not. And so very often what these systems do, and the way people have faith, you know, and I use that word very intentionally, have faith in these systems, is that they are granted the ability to be the ultimate judge on whether something's true or false or fair or not or right or wrong.
And to bring it back around, you know, what Zuckerberg is talking about is embedding these kinds of systems into a world where, Janice, as you said at the top, the interaction is more than just scrolling and clicking and looking at things. There are so many points of data to be collected in a virtual world, especially as the technology improves. Imagine being able to tell, you know, read someone's body language as they move through virtual space and figure out what their arm movements mean as they're interacting with something, and being able to take that and serve them algorithmically content and advertising based on the amount of time they touch something. That is terrifying to me.
Yeah, that's like, also like, I think it's worth mentioning too, that like, there's a lot of companies out there that claim to be able to do things like this, that claim to be able to read people's emotional state based on their facial expressions. And honestly, like the overwhelming majority of machine learning experts that I've ever spoken to have said it's absolute nonsense. Like the human face is just like way too, like you can't accurately derive someone's mental state by looking at their face. You think about all the like micro expressions and like very subtle movements like that people make involuntarily through their faces. And like, sure, there's a way that you can probably map some of those and ascribe like categories of like surprise, laughter, blah, 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 stuff like that. But like the way in which a lot of these companies are advertising these services make it seem like they can actually kind of like almost read your mind by looking at your facial expressions or your body movements and stuff like that. And I think it's like important to both acknowledge that, yes, it is potentially very harmful to like be collecting this data. And I do think that regardless of whether or not it's correct or accurate, you know, we've seen in the past that like, it will be utilized. It will be like utilized in order to make inferences and assumptions about people. But at the same time, we also have to acknowledge that like a lot of these things are just not very good. And they're not like, they're kind of snake oil in a lot of cases. Like you can't, they're just simply things you can't do with machine learning. Like even in its advanced stage right now, like you can't read a person's mind by examining their face, no matter how many data points you collect. So I think it's like both of those things can be true simultaneously. Like the data can be inaccurate and undependable, and companies are also going to use it anyway in order to make inferences about people's behaviors.
No, yeah. If I could just, I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
If I could just add to this, you know, Jathan Sadowski has a term he calls a Potemkin AI, I think, which is really useful in this case. And I think in some ways, although it's not primarily AI or only AI, we can think about the metaverse in these terms too, which is that companies, a lot of time tech companies or representatives of tech companies make wild claims about what a tech can do, not because it can do that thing at this time, or that in some cases it will ever be able to do that thing because it's impossible, but to sort of serve as a placeholder, like a sort of foundation of hype that holds the place of that, that sort of holds that belief in place until the time when that the tech is better. But in part, the other part of that is that it goes relatively unexamined by people who don't spend a lot of time looking at these things, right? So the idea that, you know, there's ever going to be some super intelligent AI, or that, you know, that's going to take over the world, or that you can look at someone's expressions or body language or listen to their voice. We could spend all day listing the things that people say AI and ML can do that it not only can't, but probably never will be able to do. But that is sort of secondary to the belief and the investment in that comes from putting those claims out into the open. You know, I mean, I've seen, for instance, like the military buys wholesale into this, right? Like that there's going to be some AI, like super intelligent AI that, can like wage war in the place of humans, right? Like all these things, right? And so it's in some ways like a really kind of keen investment strategy that sort of holds in place an idea, whether or not it's accurate, but it allows people to act as if. Lots of harms come from that.
The military is a really good example. Sometimes it seems that they feel quite credulous in what they're willing to believe. They also like to name things Skynet all the time. It's just like asking for trouble. So how do we fight back against this? One data point in this is Chris. Normally we've started to stream these on Twitch. We're not doing it today because you're uncomfortable being on camera. Or maybe that's perhaps the wrong way to put it. So can you tell us why we can't see your lovely face right now?
Yeah. So, I mean, basically the way I put it is that I have a broad-based rejection to all forms of surveillance. And so when I have the opportunity to not participate, I do. And so, as someone who spends a lot of time looking at these systems, I know that there's no, unless I destroyed every electronic device I had and moved out into the middle of the woods, right, there's no escaping it. But there are ways of rejecting it when we can. And because I have the privilege of doing that, I also want to make it make a very public show of it so that other people might use that as an example. And so to use a specific example, I teach, right? And I know that a lot, especially in the past 2 years, a lot of professors have some type of camera on policy. There's a couple different problems I have with that. One is that it exposes students to a kind of surveillance from companies that we shouldn't have the right to demand of them. But the other thing is it exposes students to a kind of surveillance from the professor, from other people in the class, right? It assumes that we have the right to see into people's homes. And it also assumes a lot of other things about like stable internet connections and distraction-free environments, like all these things that are based on like class and privilege and access and things like that. And so, the facial recognition industry that scrapes our images from a lot of these platforms has some deep roots in white supremacy and racial discrimination. So whenever I can say no to that, I say no to it.
Janice, do you have any tips for avoiding the surveillance state?
I mean, that's a pretty good point that Chris made about like just like the individual refusal, which I think is important, although, you know, it's obviously like something that's very like, you know, localized in the sense that like, ultimately these are systems that are at a very deep level, as we've been discussing, at a very deep level on our society. And the production of this technology is entirely a result of, you know, the world that we live in, and the like, you know, here in America, we're a, you know, genocidal colonial project that was basically built on top of the slave labor of other people. And so, you know, that is basically the base operating system, if you will, of all of the technology that is built on top of it. So, but I do also think that what Chris is saying is really great, because it's the acts of individual refusal, and specifically when you're a teacher or when you're someone who is like involving students and, you know, when you have a degree of care for other people, offering them the option to not expose themselves to these systems and like being able to like consent or not consent, because like ultimately what I always have said about privacy is that it's basically just consent, right? It's consent practices with a view towards, you know, technology, because what you're saying is essentially like, I do not consent to having my image reproduced and my data about myself transmitted to these companies or in this way. Because what you're actually talking about when you talk about algorithms and surveillance, and I was touching on this a bit before, is like, basically like it's our bodies that are basically being acted upon by a machinic logic that determines, that makes judgments and determinations about who we are and, you know, what our significance is to other people. And it's like the kind of thing where, you know, everybody judges each other, right? Like you go out in the street, like I go on the train and I'm looking at other people and like judging their outfits and stuff like that, because I'm a shifty Scorpio and I love to judge people silently. But like, you know, it's another thing to go from like an individual kind of like judgment that comes from this limited interaction that I have with a person on the other side of the train, and a digitized, scalable interaction where I can observe all people on all trains and make determinations about all of those people based on their body movements, their style of dress, their various things about them. So like, yeah, like I've used the term like machinic logic, because like that's basically what is happening when we're under surveillance in a time when algorithms are used to make determinations about people, is that we're being sort of subjected to this machinic logic, which makes inferences and observations about other people, which may not be accurate, but it doesn't actually matter whether or not they're accurate. What matters is that those inferences are being made, and it kind of removes a sense of agency from yourself, right? Because like a person's ability to define themselves is extremely important. That's the basis of all autonomy. And you're kind of removing someone's autonomy in a way. And so that's why I was saying what Chris was saying was really important about, you know, giving people the option to opt out, and or more importantly, to not automatically opt people in, because a lot of times people won't be prepared to be informed enough to like actually make a consensual decision, right? Like people, you talk about not having the ability to consent, right? Like when someone is like, when you're at a party and someone is like intoxicated, like they don't have the ability to consent. In the same way, like a person who can't understand how their data is going to be potentially manipulated and used, and how their like inferences made about them by algorithms would be used against them, someone who doesn't have the ability to comprehend all that is not able to consent to that kind of surveillance. So I think like starting with that understanding is a big part to answering your question about like what we can do about it, is just like understanding the limits of consent and how that applies to these systems.
Do either of you think that there's, my last question, do any of you think that there's, and we kind of touched on it earlier, a possibility that this thing will fall on its face? Facebook seems deeply uncool right now. You know, they timed this announcement to roll out right as, you know, there's all these investigations and the Facebook papers are coming out, and these deeply troubling questions about what it's doing behind the scenes. You know, VR is a pain in the ass. It makes some people sick and it's very expensive. I feel like the market for putting a port in your brain, Elon Musk, is going to be pretty small. It just feels like younger generations look at this stuff and think like, no. And I mean, Zuckerberg's, his big piece of killer tech is meetings without legs. Super cool. Like, it just feels like maybe this won't take off. Is that a possibility here?
I think it's a distinct possibility, but we've all got work to do if we want to make that so. I mean, a couple things. I think the glass holes is a great example, right? The flop of Google Glass. You know, I do think that there's, so one of the things that I think Facebook has learned, as well as other companies, is to give lip service to a lot of things, whether or not they're going to do them, right? So we've heard in the launch of Meta and of Facebook Stories and all those things, we've heard them say some of the right things about whether or not, say, they're going to have facial recognition in their projects or their products. What, you know, whether or not they're going to engage with communities to ask what they want, or what, you know, whether or not there'll be consent or people will be able to opt out. I don't think that any of these claims that they're making are genuine. You know, this is a far cry from move fast and break things, right? So they've learned at least that they have to say the right things, but we have to make it so that they have to do the right things. And the only way, the only thing that these companies understand, unfortunately, is force, right? They're never going to do the right thing because it is the right thing. But the other thing is, I think it's intentional that we've seen meetings as like the use case right now, right? Because that is one of the ways in which we could have these products forced on us, right? Rather than like choose to use them. And so it's kind of funny, right? That it seems like their best idea is like, how can we make meetings worse? But like I think that the insidiousness of that is that if your boss says you have to get one, or if your boss buys one for everyone in the office, then we're all going to be using them, right? Like, this can't be overstated. You know, everyone uses Slack. You know, I mean, people don't know that Slack stands for supreme log of all communication and knowledge. Right,
like, I didn't know that.
Didn't make that up, right?
That's, I just thought it was an IRC ripoff from the cloud.
It started.
Yeah,
I was like, this is just IRC except in the cloud.
It was like the chat room for a really strange little MMO that not a lot of people played.
Yeah,
that got spun off. Yeah,
but that's what that stands for. I want to be careful with how I say this, but with one of the lessons from Google Glass is that there is a measure of social punishment from doing things that are violations of social codes. That whether it was uncool or, you know, more severe, you know, people having more severe reactions, like, it was a violation of people's space in many ways. So you know, walk into a party or a bar, or, you know, a bedroom or whatever, wearing like Google Glasses, and society made that known. And you know, there's a lot of other ways. I mean, I think worker pushback, I think the fact that a lot of workers are revolting against Facebook, you know, I think unionizing. So there are lots of ways. I mean, I think that, you know, that legislation is now not only possible, but likely. I think all these things make it so that something like the metaverse is not inevitable, but I also think we don't want to rest and just assume it's going to fail because Facebook is sort of like took a punch.
All right.
Yeah.
Sorry, Janice, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say I think like the cultural pushback has a huge role here. Like what Chris was saying about how, you know, like if your boss forces you to wear this thing, like, and then, and you know, can then be used for, it can then be used, to monitor, prisoners, or, you know, it's like the same, this is like kind of how tech is introduced and it's not inevitable. And I think that, like, you know, you think about, the example I like with Google Glass is like, we're talking about the metaverse, and there's a character in William Stevenson's Snow Crash, called the Gargoyle, who is literally a CIA stringer, who wears like goggles and like all this like sensor stuff and just goes around recording things and sends them to the Central Intelligence Corporation, which is basically like Facebook or Google or whatever. And the way that Stevenson describes the Gargoyle in the novel is absolutely hated. Like, everyone fucking hates this guy. And so it's like, it's kind of like almost like an echo of that. And I think it also goes to show what Chris was saying, which is that, you know, it's not just because a tech corporation is introducing this doesn't mean it's inevitable. And I think that like a lot of like the cultural reaction to things like Google Glass and things like the metaverse is going to determine a lot about whether it's actually implemented or whether it's actually the thing that happens in the future.
All right. Well, I would love to sit here and keep having this conversation. I could do it for another hour, but I'm going to start the outro music because I need to let y'all go. Chris, where can people find your work?
I am on Twitter. I'm extremely online at Hypervisible. I sometimes write for Real Life and Fast Company, and I may have a piece coming out in Wired soon.
And Janice, where can people find you? Obviously on the fine website, motherboard.vice.com.
I am on the fine website, Motherboard. And I'm also on Twitter at Janice Rose, spelled with a U, J-A-N-U-S. Yeah.
All right. Thank you both so much for coming onto Cyber and walking me through this.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.